Hello, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies. I'm Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the network. Every month or so, we interview the author of a new book in genocide studies. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Dan Stone, professor of history at the University of London, to the show. When I was in grad school, everyone who even had a passing interest in the Holocaust read Michael Maris's book, The Holocaust in History. The book was a model of historical scholarship, fair yet assertive in its judgments, retrospective in coverage, yet forward-looking in its assessment of the field. The book was well-received, it was read by, as I say, generations of graduate students, and it was a standard. The book has now been supplanted by Dan's recent study, Histories of the Holocaust, published by Oxford University Press. And Dan's book is every bit as fundamental in assessing the field as was Maris's, judicious, illuminating, and enormously comprehensive. Generations of grad students will find themselves reading the book, as will both professional and amateur historians. I'm thrilled to have Dan on the show today, and I'd like to start our conversation, Dan, both by saying thanks for joining us and inviting you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a historian.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks very much for inviting me. I came to study the Holocaust, I guess, for a whole host of reasons. I think it was part of my consciousness when I was growing up. It was something that was part of family history. My father took me to Yad Vashem when I was 11. I knew about the Holocaust. And when I was an undergraduate studying history, I knew from very early on in my first year as an undergraduate that I wanted to be a historian. I was so intellectually stimulated by my studies, I really wanted to carry on. So the question was, I think, how to find something that would be stimulating enough to make me, as a graduate student, get out of bed in the morning. I think that's the key problem, isn't it, for a PhD student? You want to do something, but you're working on your own fundamentally, especially in the British system, unlike in the US, where there are no classes to go to and so on. You have to be self-motivated. And in the third year of my undergraduate degree, I can remember shortly before I was due to take my finals, I was supposed to be revising. I came across in the main bookshop in Oxford, Saul Friedlander's edited volume, Probing the Limits of Representation, which is conference papers from a famous conference at UCLA in 1991. And I was so excited by this book, I bought it and spent a couple of days sitting in the Bodleian Library reading it instead of revising for my finals. And that was what motivated me to go on. I knew I wanted to do something related to the Holocaust. But what excited me about that book in particular was, I think, a particular intellectual moment. Debates about postmodernism, about representation, about narrative, and so on, were perhaps already becoming old hat in the States, but in Oxford, and I think in the UK more generally, they were still relatively fresh and relatively controversial and exciting. And for me, this conjunction of, I think, quite conceptually complex and exciting ideas about how history should be written, particularly as they were being debated with respect to the Holocaust, was something that really fired my imagination and made me want to get going with my further research.
Yeah, I read the website, the official university website, and on there you are, and maybe you wrote this, maybe somebody else did it, described as a historian of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
good, excellent. So how does that shape your approach to investigating the Holocaust?
Well, I think there are lots of ways to write about the Holocaust, of course, and most historians begin life, particularly in their training as graduate students, writing archival history, writing event history. What I was more interested in as a graduate student, and still to some extent today, was thinking less. I didn't want to write a study of, I don't know, let's say children in the Witch Ghetto or Fifth Army at Stalingrad, whatever it happened to be. I wanted to think more about how history is written. And what's so fantastic, I think, about the historiography of the Holocaust is precisely that it's so vast and so sophisticated. And it acts as a way of understanding historiography in general and the way in which we write history in general. So all the questions that were being debated with respect to Holocaust historiography in the early 1990s are really questions about how we write history at all, And that's what I found so exciting. And so by history of ideas, I partly mean historiography, the history of history writing. But in general, I mean, because the Holocaust is only one of the things that I work on, I've also worked on history of race thinking, history of anthropology, the history of the cultural politics of the far right in Britain in the early 20th century, for example. I'm interested in ideologies, about the spread of ideas, the ways in which ideas and action interact. And I use the term history of ideas to distinguish it from, I suppose, what's more of an American tradition, intellectual history, which, the two things are more or less synonymous. But I think intellectual history smacks to some extent of history of philosophy, of the history of great men, and if you can think of a journal like the Journal of the History of Ideas, which is a fabulous journal, but tends, I think, very much to be about good taste, ideas that we want to remember from the Renaissance and the Enlightenment onwards, whereas History of Ideas, I think, is more about ideas in context. That's to say, that's an idea borrowed from the Cambridge School, Skinner and Pocock and so on. And that also requires you, I think, to think not just about ideas that we don't like or that have informed our tradition, but ideas that we don't like, ideas that have been forgotten or dismissed, and to try and show how at any given point in time a whole host of ideas are circulating and competing in society. And the ones that we remember are often, in fact, the ones that are the most aberrant, because they're the ones that are the greatest ideas. If you think of the historiography on Hobbes, for example, it's clearly phenomenally important, but Hobbes is not a representative thinker of his time. So the great thinkers are precisely people who don't, in some ways, tell us most about their age. And I want always to think about people who are more representative of the age, which is why I've spent a lot of time also working on obscure figures in the history of British fascism. Not important as thinkers, but important for telling us something about the circulation of ideas at any points in time. But with respect to the Holocaust, I think there I'm more interested from a presentist point of view. I'm more interested there in historiography, strictly speaking, that's to say the history of history writing, debates about methodology, and thinking about how historiography does not take place in a vacuum, that the debates that go on amongst historians of the Holocaust take place in a very wide range of contexts, geographical or political, linguistic, cultural, and so on. And those contexts, I think, are crucial for understanding the ways in which debates in Holocaust historiography are shaped and developed. So I was interested, I think some historians still think perhaps that writing the history of history writing is not real history somehow. I always had that sense that when I was a graduate student in Oxford, there was a certain sniffiness about my interests. But historians' texts are also part of the world and can therefore also be historicized like anything else. Therefore, I've always been fascinated by the ways in which a phenomenon that is so intensively studied is studied, because that is how we know it. We know it primarily through the representations of it that we produce.
Excellent. So how did you come to decide to write this book?
I guess because I could. and what I mean by that is that I think a lot of the ideas there have been percolating for a very long time. I don't want to make myself sound longer in the tooth than I am, but I've been thinking about some of these topics since I was an undergraduate. And so over 20 years then, a lot of these topics are things that have been playing on my mind. And having taught a third-year undergraduate what's traditionally called in this country special subject, i.e. a document-based course, which is aimed at, if you like, the initial stage of training for historians, having taught a course like that on the Holocaust for a dozen years or so, I felt able to do it in a way that I haven't been beforehand. That I felt like not only that I knew the literature well enough, but that my own ideas had settled to some extent. And therefore, I thought it was worth doing. And of course, you know, you started off by mentioning Maris. Maris's book is still, I think, a wonderful book, but its only real flaw, which is, of course, not Maris's fault, is that it's out of date. That's why historiography is important. It's necessarily out of date because it was published in 1987. And since the end of the Cold War, the availability of archival material and the development of historiography of the Holocaust has been phenomenal. And so I think there was a need for the book, as well as a personal sense that I was able to write.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, actually. Do you see your book as an update of Maris's, or are you asking similar but not the same questions?
I think the latter. I think because I was guided mainly by the historiography itself. I mean, those are my sources. So the shape of the book was partly determined by my own interests. But I think those interests have been shaped by what historians have been doing on the Holocaust since the end of the Cold War. So my sets of questions are, I think, related to Maris's, but the book is structured quite differently. So where he takes a classic division of perpetrators, victims, bystanders, I was driven more by thinking thematically about the key topics in the historical. And I think that's partly because I think that way of approaching is intellectually more stimulating. But secondly, I think it was a reflection of the state of the field, actually. And I don't think it would have looked rather conventional and tedious simply to copy the structure of this book, wouldn't it? Clearly there's an enormous debt to Maris's work there. I think my book is quite different in terms of structure.
So you mentioned when in your discussion of Maris, this explosion of research after the Cold War with the opening of the archives. Mm-hmm. For some of our listeners who are perhaps not professional historians, can you say a little bit about that and about how that has shaped both the kinds of questions historians are now able to ask and perhaps any kind of constraints or limitations that arise out of the kinds of sources or maybe points of view that arise out of the kinds of sources that they're now looking at?
Yes. I think it's, first of all, a very simple point to say that until the end of the Cold War, many of the archives in Eastern Europe were simply inaccessible, or for the most part inaccessible to Western scholars. And the historiography of the Holocaust has largely been developed by Western scholars. What was written during the communist period in the communist countries is historically of interest, but there's not very much of it that is salvageable as good history writing. So first of all, there's just an enormous explosion of sources that had previously been unavailable. So, you know, the Holocaust Museum in Washington now has literally millions of records photocopied from Romania, Hungary, Poland, and so on. And all of those countries also now have their own flourishing, to a greater or lesser extent, of historiography, research institutes, journals, and so on, devoted to the subject in a way that was impossible until the end of the Cold War. The key way I think that has reshaped the historiography is that it has shifted our understanding of the Holocaust eastwards, which is extremely important because I still think, particularly in the UK, and I think possibly in the States as well, our mental image of the Holocaust is, and we carry a kind of image of the entrance gate to Birkenau in our heads, but we also, I think, have images of the deportation trains from Western Europe. And we think about the deportation of the German Jews, the Jews in France and the Netherlands and so on, all of which, of course, there's no reason why we shouldn't have those images, but the vast majority of the Holocaust's victims were Eastern European Jews, mostly Orthodox religious Jews, who were killed in Eastern Europe. The shifting eastwards of our historical vision of the Holocaust has been one very important consequence of the opening of those archives. The problems that engenders, I think, are for thinking about how to incorporate Western Europe and Eastern Europe together, then, how to think of the Holocaust as a whole. And so sometimes in the recent literature, there's a tendency to write about Eastern Europe in a way that forgets Western Europe as a kind of overcompensation, perhaps, for previous efforts. And there's still a need, I think, to provide a synthetic account which allows us to remember that although the numbers were comparatively small, the Jews of Western Europe should also not be forgotten, and the Jews of the Balkans and so on as well. I think this becomes particularly acute. Maybe this is something we'll discuss a little later, when in the context of debates about colonialism and the Holocaust, and all the Holocaust as a colonial genocide, which is a concept that, that makes a lot of sense when thinking about the invasion of the Soviet Union and the face-to-face killings of the Jews by the Einsatzgruppen or the mobile killing squads in Eastern Europe. But it's harder to square with the murder of the Jews of Western Europe. So I think it's been, on the one hand, it's very important, a salutary reminder of just where the Holocaust happened and who its victims were, primarily. But it doesn't solve all our problems.
Yeah, I was intrigued in the course of discussing this question of whether the Holocaust was a German event or a European event, mm-hmm. or something else. You make the point that it's perhaps not helpful to talk about the Holocaust, but rather we should think about this as the Holocausts, mm-hmm. plural. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that's a better way to understand this experience?
Because I think, and again, this comes from the opening up of the Eastern European archives, though not only from those. The end of the Cold War also, I think, has given rise to a reassessment across Europe of collaboration and the continent-wide span of the Holocaust, because what we've discovered, and this is made particularly clear, I think, in all the national commissions that have been produced since the end of the Cold War across Europe, is that what the Holocaust was a pan-European phenomenon that could not have been carried out by the Germans alone. And so we still, again, there's a kind of fixed template in our head of what the Holocaust was, this, you know, the German murder of the Jews. And yet, we see this more and more. First of all, everywhere in Europe, the Germans relied on local collaboration, whether that's at the level of the state or of institutions such as auxiliary police forces, or at the level of individuals, simply pointing out who is Jewish, who is not, and so on. But also, we see that in some instances, although the Nazi authorities give a kind of green light to the killing process, actually the Germans are relatively uninvolved. So in the case of Slovakia, of France, of Yugoslavia, and especially of Romania, we really see these countries, as is sometimes written in the historiography, solving the Jewish question their own way. So in the case of Romania, which was the largest Allied force to accompany the Wehrmacht invading the Soviet Union, you see the murder of the Jews of Romania and of Romanian-occupied Ukraine, so-called Transnistria, carried out by the Romanians themselves. And I don't think they would have done this outside of the context of the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union and the war on Judeo-Bolshevism and the search for Lebensraum and so on. But nevertheless, it's not the Germans who killed the Jews of Odessa or of Transnistria. It was the Romanians. And that was something that was relatively unknown, I think, until quite recently.
Yeah, I think I'm reading you right, and correct me if I've misread you, but my sense is that you believe we're basically at a point after 20 years of kind of looking at these Eastern European archives and reassessing what we think about the Holocaust, that we can draw some consequent or some conclusions about the decision to launch the Holocaust with some degree of confidence. But I don't, what I found interesting about your discussion of this is precisely that debate, that emerging consensus seems to be a German or emerging consensus about the German process, and there doesn't seem to be a parallel literature addressing the decisions of these smaller states. Mm-hmm. Is that an accurate kind of read of the literature, or am I missing?
No, that's very interesting. I think that what that points up is the limits, if you like, of the Holocaust approach. Mm-hmm. That's to say, as I said a few minutes ago, the, if you like, indigenous attacks on the Jews would not have happened without the green light provided by the Germans. And there, I think, what you said just now precisely points to that fact. The decision-making process is a German decision-making process, and that once the, I mean, if there is a decision for the final solution, which seems rather implausible in some ways, but once the final solution is in full swing by the middle of 1942, it's clear, I think, that the Germany's allies can also go ahead and do the same thing. But that decision-making process is to some extent driven by Germany's allies, so the Slovakians, Vichy France, and so on, making their own legislation or pushing the Germans to deport Jews. So there's a two-way process going on there. But I do think you're right in a sense to say that we still come back to thinking about the leaders of Nazi Germany in order to recreate this this process. That was, again, something that that was very important in the so-called regional studies of the Holocaust, which is also one of the consequences of the opening up of the Eastern European archives, is that many historians, primarily German historians, produced very detailed studies of regions of Eastern Europe, such as Galicia, Lithuania, Belarus, or wherever it happened to be. And often the details of what happened on the ground tended to obscure the fact that although there's a two-way process between the center in Berlin and periphery in Eastern Europe, actually the real decision-making was still being made in Berlin. And sometimes that gets forgotten, I think. And that default position is starting, I think, to return in the literature. If you look at Saul Friedlander's book or Peter Longerich's work, I think we're reminded again that for all the importance of the regions and Nazi Germany's allies, actually the key decision-making was being done in Berlin.
And so you use the phrase, and I think, I can't remember, is it Mommsen's? You talk about cumulative radicalization. Mm. If I'm right that you think there is an emerging consensus on not the quote-unquote decision to launch the Holocaust, but how the Holocaust emerged out of this kind of German set of policymakers and actions. What is your sense of what that process or what that consensus is?
That's in some ways a simple question, in some ways a very difficult one. I think that the consensus, if there is one, seems to me to, first of all, to require some understanding of the so-called intentionalist-functionalist debate, which probably most people listening will be familiar with, because it's something that I think students learn about, certainly here when they're still at school and then at university. And although that debate is not the be-all and end-all of the historiography, it still remains quite important. And so where I think the consensus has emerged is, first of all, I think to say that the functionalist argument, that's to say that policy was being made on an ad hoc basis, that there was no predetermined blueprint for genocide, is absolutely correct. You can see this, that otherwise it makes no sense. Why are the Germans still passing laws forbidding German Jews to own pets in 1941 whilst they're busy murdering the Jews of Poland? So there's clearly no properly coordinated master plan from 1919 or 1925 or 1933, whenever date you choose. But that also doesn't mean that, as Mommsen, I think, primarily argued, that the Germans kind of fall into this plan, into this program by accident. Actually, what remains so important from the intentionalist argument, that's to say that Hitler had a plan to kill the Jews, which he then implemented at the first opportunity, is not the notion of the plan, but the notion of a fantasy, if you like. So Nazism as a movement, as a way of thinking, necessarily involves eradicating the Jew, if you like. And so I think from very early on, there's an incipient fantasy within the Nazi worldview, which is about what Alon Confino calls a world without Jews. That doesn't mean that there is a plan to get rid of the Jews, but it means that there's a kind of vision of, or a desire, even if it's unstated somehow, to make this world a reality. And the consensus that's emerging, I think, in the historiography largely, is that for all the things that we associate with the functionalist argument, the notions of polycracy, of institutional Darwinism, competition between different Nazi agencies, incoherence, the lack of clear channels of communication, and so on, what all these different agencies and institutions that are, whether they're party or state institutions, whether it's the Wehrmacht or the Office of the Five-Year Plan or the RUSHA or the Gestapo, what they all share ultimately is this desire to get rid of the Jews. So there is a kind of what they share is an anti-Semitic consensus. And what I think historians now share, no matter whether they're writing about specifically about Nazi anti-Semitism, for example, in so-called institutes of Judenforschung, so institutes for Jewish research at universities or non-university institutions, which are specifically devoted to understanding the Jewish question, or whether they're writing about local government in the Third Reich, increasingly we see historians are showing how so much of this of Nazi decision-making policy was filtered through a shared understanding of the need to get rid of the Jews. And sometimes that means a disagreement about how to do this or when it should be done. Christopher Browning writes brilliantly about this in terms of the debate between productionists and attritionists in the ghettos, those who think the Jews should be put to work until the end of the war and then they can be got rid of, those who just want to get rid of them immediately. And so that helps to explain the different lifespans of the different ghettos, for example. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, even those who are productionists, they're not in favor of sustaining Jewish life in Europe. They simply want to keep the Jews alive whilst they're useful. And so that's the consensus that's emerging.
And you have a nice phrase for this. You talk about the return of ideology. Mm-hmm. Why does that happen now?
I think, again, that's a post-Cold War phenomenon. From the 60s and 70s, the key interpretive frameworks were either fascism for those on the left or totalitarianism for those more on the right. And in the 1980s, what you see, thanks to Tim Mason and Martin Borchardt and Hans Mommsen and others, is the rise of the functionalist paradigm. So I don't think this happens outside of academia primarily, but I think, you know, if you ask the man on the Tel Aviv omnibus in the mid 1980s why the Nazis killed the Jews, you know, that would be a rather stupid question. He'll say, well, it's because they hated the Jews. But historians in the 1980s were starting to argue that actually there was no clear policy was made on the hoof and so on. And that, I think, culminates with Bauman's book of 1989, Modernity and the Holocaust, which we can go on to discuss if you like. But after, I think, the 1990s, what you see, and again, this has something to do with the documents that come from the Eastern European archives, we see a much closer involvement of individuals in the whole process. And so the more historians produce these very detailed regional studies, these almost micro histories of particular regions, the more they saw the importance of not just, if you like, from the functionist perspective, institutions or offices or a bureaucracy of murder, but the more they understood that this bureaucracy didn't in itself kill people, that actually there had to be people on the ground carrying out these atrocities. And particularly when you think of the first wave of the Holocaust, the Einsatzgruppen killings in the Soviet Union, this is not a factory line genocide in the way that Bauman writes about. This is brutal, vicious, face-to-face murder of the most shocking kind. And I think a lot of the literature on the theme of modernity, for example, had become a bit taken with its own terminology. Factory line genocide, industrial genocide, and so on. As though this is somehow shocking about our modern world, but it actually wasn't a description of what the Holocaust was really like. Certainly not in its first stages, and that was a rediscovery driven by, I think, the accessibility of new archives in the early 1990s. And so from that, there's then a rediscovery of. Or a sense that, well, if these people on the ground are doing this, what's the justification for it? And so historians started to investigate subjects like ideological indoctrination in the Wehrmacht, the intellectuals amongst the SD or the SS, so historians like Michael Wirth, for example, have written very important studies of the real SD intellectuals, these people who are not just have their, you know, their PhDs in law and careerists and so on, but are really violent anti-Semites. And so there's a recreation of a whole kind of generation that comes to power in Germany on the collapse of the Weimar Republic. Not just the stereotypical Nazi thugs, but also people who have a kind of modern understanding of the world. They're technocrats in some ways, but who also have a sort of mystical sense that the salvation of Germany will only come about through the annihilation of the Jew. So I think this we shouldn't go too far with the return of ideology as an argument. In fact, I think there have already been conferences, and I think there are publications coming which will ask the question: Have we gone too far with this notion? If we talk, for example, about the notion of the Volksgemeinschaft, so this is the Nazi concept of the racial community, if we use that concept to think about what Nazi Germany was like, do we grant too much credence to the Nazis' own view of the world? So do we end up overstating the extent to which they were actually able to create this Volksgemeinschaft? In other words, the Nazis may have seen the world through the lenses of race, but we shouldn't be seduced by that into thinking that that was actually the reality that they created. Nevertheless, I don't think it's possible anymore to go back to a situation as in the 1980s, where one could talk about bureaucratic genocide without some sense of the ideological process behind it.
Yeah, it's both in your book and in your kind of the way you instinctively answer these kind of questions, what I hear, and maybe I'm wrong, but what I hear is the sense from you that the period from maybe the late 80s through the early 2000s was really a period of historians trying to get their understanding, to make their understanding of the Holocaust accurate,
mm-hmm.
that it was about decisions and dates and motivations, and what we've and here, you know, like I said, correct me if I'm wrong, but that we've now perhaps gotten to a point where we are turning back to more kind of fundamental questions about the meaning of the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and how it relates to modernity or to human nature. Is that a sense of where you see the historiography going?
I certainly see part of it going that way. I think there will always be, and we see this with the continuing slew of publications, which shows no sign of slowing down. There will always be historians, I think this particularly with respect to the publication of PhDs, there will always be historians who want to write archive-based studies of a particular aspect of the Holocaust that has not been studied in detail before. And what's so extraordinary, and again, you can think about the amount of documents that are held at the USHMM, what's so extraordinary is that these studies continue to appear. I mean, there's simply no shortage of sources to allow this to happen. But the size of the historiography means, I think, that whilst there's no reason why these studies shouldn't continue to appear, I mean, they absolutely should, it's the lifeblood of any historical study, there is also the need to step back a little and say, what does it all mean? Hilberg, for example, always claimed, this is what he claimed in Lanzmann's film, Shoah, that he he always wanted to address the smaller questions, the how, the mechanics of the Holocaust, because he was afraid of the big questions, the why. And I always thought that was false modesty, that actually throughout his work, which was, of course, innovative and archive-based, nevertheless, the why questions are always present. And he did address them on several occasions too. And so those questions are there, whether we address them directly or not.
Yeah.
And so I think we should address them, because they're the things that motivate historians' interest in the Holocaust in the first place. I think, you know, all those of us who choose to work on the Holocaust do so for all sorts of powerful... I describe my motivation at the start of the interview as being about intellectual excitement, but it's never only intellectual, it's also emotional and personal. And so, and yet, as professional historians, we're taught to kind of write those feelings out of our work. And actually, there's no reason why they shouldn't become driving questions. We should also think about why we're doing this. You know, why are we so fascinated by this topic still? In some ways, why are we more fascinated by it than ever, with all the research institutes and libraries and transnational institutes and organizations devoted to it? We should step back and think about what it all means. And so we can do that in terms of thinking about, if you like, popular culture or collective memory, but also, as you suggest, in a more academic style, by asking more conceptual or quasi-philosophical questions, such as the one about modernity. And that's, of course, those are long-standing questions, but throughout the 1990s, I think they got a little neglected in some ways, precisely because all these new empirical studies were being done. And now, although the empirical studies continue to be produced, we have enough of them to be able to step back a little and reassess the state of the field.
Yeah, I don't mean to sidetrack us too much, but I was shocked is too much of a word, but you point out in your discussion of Bauman and this whole issue of modernity and the Holocaust that the new understanding we have based on new research of the camps in Poland, the killing camps mm-hmm. especially, suggests that even in the places which are kind of stereotypically understood as factory-like assembly mm-hmm. lines, they actually weren't. And so I guess I would ask, how did it take us that long to do the research on things that are so stereotypically representative of the Holocaust?
Well, I think there are different levels to that question. I mean, first of all, there's one about the creation of collective memories, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes us right back to the liberation of the camps, to who liberated which camps. Don't forget that, you know, the Red Army liberated Auschwitz and Majdanek.
Right.
The Operation Reinhardt camps, Belzec, Sobibor and Treblinka, had already been dismantled by the end of 1943, so there was very little there to actually see. And the Western Allies liberated many camps, but primarily we remember Buchenwald, Dachau and Bergen-Belsen, and they were not extermination camps. They were in the appalling conditions they were at the end of the war because of the death marches to the camps and the total neglect of those inmates at the end of the war. And so there was a kind of conceptual confusion built into the Western collective memory of the Holocaust from the very start, about where the Holocaust took place, who its victims were, and so on. But secondly, it has to do with, if you like, practical considerations. About 1.5 million of the Holocaust's victims were killed in the Operation Reinhardt camps. But because they were dismantled, there's very little by way of source material. It was very difficult. You know, there were two survivors from Belzec, and more from Treblinka, but still very few. It took a long time for sources to be found, to become accessible. Whereas Auschwitz, as Peter Hayes calls it, became the capital of the Holocaust, precisely because so many, not just because so many people were killed there, I mean, the same number were killed at Treblinka, but because so many people had passed through it from everywhere in Europe. And so Auschwitz was relatively well known, particularly by the 1990s, after the I think this problem of Belsen or Dachau being considered to be the centres of the Holocaust had finally been overcome, and we started to understand actually the majority of those killed in gas chambers were killed in Treblinka and Auschwitz. But it was, first of all, it's difficult. I mean, there's still only a couple of books on the Reinhard camps, because I think it's very hard to find material. But what we do know now, and as you say, is that the more that's discovered about this, the more this notion of factory line genocide is inapplicable. Not because lots of people weren't killed in a short space of time, they were, but the process, by calling it industrial line genocide, I think we shield ourselves from the true nature of what was actually going on there. Treblinka was a bit like, I mean, it's been described as the Wild East generally. I think, you know, this is a place surrounded by booty hunters, prostitutes, alcohol-fueled violence. I mean, it's terrible. It bears no resemblance to a kind of the clinical vision that is conjured up by the notion of industrial line genocide, you know, clean factories and workers in overalls. It's not like that at all. It's actually extremely brutal and gruesome. There are descriptions of the engines that were used to power the gas chambers breaking down, and all sorts of terrible descriptions, which we don't need to go into now. But it's I think people don't want to hear it in a way. Although we can read this stuff, but to actually make it break into the collective memory and to replace a kind of easy and rather unchallenging notion of factory line genocide is altogether more difficult.
Yeah, and here I wanted to kind of parenthetically say there's way more in the book than we're going to be able to talk about in this short interview, and so I encourage the listeners to go out and read it, because it's a wonderful summary of the knowledge that we have now. Here I want to say this seems a logical point to talk about your discussion of genocide and how the Holocaust fits into this broader notion of genocide, because one of the ways in which people have often distinguished the Holocaust from other genocides is exactly this notion that the Holocaust was somehow modern and mechanical and industrial, as opposed to the killing in Rwanda or Cambodia or something like this. So how has Holocaust studies been informed by this broader field of genocide studies?
That's actually, I think, quite a hard question. It's much easier to show how genocide studies has been informed by Holocaust studies.
And I'm happy to have you talk about that as well.
Well, I won't, because I know that, you know, Donald Bloxham and others have already discussed that with you, so I don't think there's any need for me to go into that in great detail, other than to say that I think it's very interesting that many scholars who have become genocide scholars began as students of the Holocaust. And so there's sometimes, it sometimes seems as though there's a kind of conflict between Holocaust studies and genocide studies. And there are those who argue that the Holocaust gets too much attention and it distracts from the study of other genocides. And I'm not really sure that's true, that actually, if it were not for people who wrote about the Holocaust, then going on to write about genocide, genocide studies as a discipline would not be, or as a field, let's say, it's not a discipline, as a field would not exist in the way it does now. And if people think that other genocides are neglected, well, go out and study them. There's no problem with that. But the opposite, reverse of that, which is how has genocide studies impacted on Holocaust studies, I think the key way here is through thinking about genocide as less through the legalistic way in which the term was initially defined and created by Lemkin and United Nations and so on, rather to think historically about genocide as the unfolding of a process, as a dynamic. And that's what you do see very clearly, I think, in the historiography of the Holocaust of the 1990s, the regional studies and so on. And that, I think, automatically speaks against the modernity argument to some extent, because the modernity argument suggests that that the Nazis decided to establish camps. This is where the Jews were killed. Actually, of course, the death camps are the very end of a process that began much earlier, and they are in some senses aberrant. Actually, the Reinhard camps used very primitive motor engines to kill the Jews. Auschwitz, which is where you see the use of Zyklon B, which is also a very simple rat poison, basically, to kill people in gas chambers. It's hardly technologically sophisticated, but it was, in some sense, aberrant anyway. By the time that the Jews of Hungary are killed in March to July 1944, actually the vast majority of the Holocaust victims have already been killed. Browning, again, talks about this very eloquently. He says that at the start of 1942, 80% of the victims of the Holocaust are still alive, whereas by the start of 1943, 80% of the victims of the Holocaust are dead. And those people have been primarily been killed either by face-to-face shooting or in these very primitive gas chambers of the Operation Reinhard camps or gas vans. So I think what genocide studies has helped us to think about, first of all, is the Holocaust as the unfolding of a process whereby one stage leads into another rather than a single decision, if you like. It makes the debate about the decision-making process seem a little less pressing than it might once have seemed. But it also brings home, I think, how the Holocaust was part of a whole trajectory and a tradition of European and world history. And Donald and others have argued this very clearly and persuasively, I think, is that if you think about the Holocaust as a phenomenon on its own, it continues to fuel a kind of Sonderweg thesis or Germans as ill, to use a kind of Kurt Vonnegut metaphor. But actually, you can't really understand the rise of Nazism and you can't understand the crimes of the Nazis without, I think, situating the Holocaust into a much broader span of European and world history. That's not an argument about simple notions of causality, you know, the Africa to Auschwitz or whatever. But it is just saying this is a much more complex phenomenon than we ever thought. And that's I think, is a real contribution from genocide studies. It's opened up, on the one hand, some debates which get a little unpleasant, but nevertheless, of some very serious questions, I think, about how to contextualize the Holocaust in the context of world history more generally.
Yeah, I'm particularly intrigued. You pointed out the kind of the implication of our research most recently, and the idea that many of the people who are killed face to face, which of course leads us to rethink the experience of the perpetrators and the motivation of the perpetrators. And of course, Browning's book, Ordinary Men, I don't know if it starts that, but at least it contributes greatly to that discussion. Yeah. That book is I don't want to say old, but it's been around for a while. And that book filters through to the genocide studies community. I'm not so sure that the kind of responses of the genocide community have filtered back to the Holocaust historians, things like Scott Strauss's book or Leanne Fuji's or Alex Hinton's. I don't know if that's just my perception or whether that's a broader claim that can be made. But
I think that's probably true. I mean, there are, of course, historians who read those books and who think about perpetrators in a comparative perspective or try to think about Holocaust perpetrators whilst drawing on literature from other genocides. But I think you're right, actually, in that the leading historians of Holocaust perpetrators, Longerich and so on, draw on a very substantial source base and historiography of the Holocaust, which is enough in a sense. You know, it's a huge literature in its own right, and so I don't think they feel. First of all, I think oftentimes they think, well, you know, I'm not an expert. I don't speak Kinyarwanda or Khmer or whatever it is, and therefore feel like it's inappropriate for them to draw on this literature. Whereas my view would always be, of course, if you do comparative work, there's always a loss in that respect. But there's also, I think, the risks involved, which are that it's broad brush or it's superficial or you're not an expert or not an area expert or a language expert. The gain is that you can nevertheless ask interesting questions and hopefully make interesting connections between things. But I guess sadly you're probably right, actually, that although there's a very substantial literature on Holocaust perpetrators, mm-hmm. It tends not to draw on the literature on perpetrators of other genocides. Perhaps the exception to that is the literature written by social psychologists, mm-hmm. Which draws also, I mean, that has its own problems, but of course draws on the famous Milgram experiments or the Stanford Prison experiments and so on, in order to try and say that this is a cross-cultural phenomenon or a situational phenomenon or whatever the argument happens to be. So it does have an impact on the field, but perhaps I think you're right to say not a very great one at the moment.
I read your book, and I imagine myself as an incoming graduate student wanting to study the Holocaust and wondering how many years it's going to take me just to become even basically fluent in the literature of the Holocaust. Where do we go now in terms of Holocaust studies with this library after library after library of book and authors that we need to know about?
I think, first of all, you have to do a master's in Holocaust studies in order to get a grounding in the literature, and then you have to make decisions. I mean, nobody can master all this stuff. I think as a starting PhD student, you then have to decide what it is you're going to work on, and immerse yourself in that literature, because it's impossible to familiarize yourself with all of it. And particularly, I mean, I'm not even talking only about the historiography, but if you want to take an interest in post-Holocaust philosophy or literary studies or film studies, museum studies, all of these have now very large literatures pertaining to the Holocaust, as does every other discipline, geography and music and so on. So you have, I think, to make some difficult choices. And I think that's really what a master's degree is for, to orient yourself in the discipline and to find the sub field that interests you most. But it's not like studying canal building in early modern England. You just have to accept the fact that you'll never be able to finish. I mean, I have to say this to PhD students: don't worry. if you as you're submitting, that yet another book has come out. It's, you know, that's just always like that.
I tell my students when they complain about the reading assignments that no, you don't have to read that book. You get to read that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
We've taken a lot of your time. I'd just like to ask, kind of as a way to move toward a conclusion, mm-hmm. first, what can you suggest one or two or maybe three books about the Holocaust that people should read now? Yeah. Maybe new books, maybe classic books. And here I'm ambushing you a little bit. Mm-hmm. I one of the things you say in your book is how perceptive the early historians of the Holocaust mm-hmm. turn out to actually have mm-hmm. been. So perhaps it's a classic book that people may not have read precisely because it's 30 or 40 years old.
Uh-huh. I think one of the things I would recommend, not by one of the early historians of the Holocaust, but about them, is Laura Jokusch's book, Collect and Record, which is about the early documentation centers that are established immediately after the end of the war in order to collect information and testimony whilst it was still fresh. Because I think in all the historiography and the debates that have been going on since the 1980s, there's been a tendency to forget the contribution made by the early historians and by the early research institutes. And Jochusch presents that material in, I think, a very exciting and fresh way. So that's certainly a book that I would recommend. And the writings of those historians, some of them are still available. A book such as Roads to Extinction by Philip Friedman, for example, which was published in about 1980, but is a collection of essays that he'd been writing since the mid-1940s, is a really important book. And actually, some of his writings are on the concept of genocide, as well as on things that were pertaining specifically to what later became called the Holocaust. So you can see that these debates are not new. They've been ongoing for a very long time, and that really we're standing on the shoulders of giants. That without the work of these people, who many of them Holocaust survivors themselves, if without them, their initial efforts to recover this material, much of our work would be much harder. So those Jochusch's book is one that I would certainly recommend, and the writings of people like Philip Friedman. But a book, since we've also talked a bit about conceptualizing the Holocaust, I'd also recommend Alon Confino's book, Foundational Pasts, which is a book which compares the state of Holocaust historiography to the historiography of the French Revolution. And he takes as his starting point François Fouret's argument that the French Revolution is over. From the 1980s, by which he means that a certain interpretation of the French Revolution is over. And Confino says the same thing about the Holocaust, that our main historiographical interpretive frameworks have reached exhaustion point. We know what we're talking about when we talk about the war, radicalization, the importance of race and ideology to Nazi Germany. Where are our new questions going to come from? I think that's a very interesting book. His answer to that is that cultural history, by which he means the ways in which people in the past provided meaning to their lives, is going to provide us with some interesting questions to ask in future years. And I agree. I mean, it's clearly not the only way that one can go about writing history, but I think it's a very exciting book in that it opens all sorts of new lines of inquiry.
It looks like my weekend is now booked.
Good.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I've got from a lot of the work that I've done on the historiography of the Holocaust and the contextualization of the Holocaust, I became more interested generally in post-war European history. And I recently edited the Oxford Handbook of Post-War European History. And then as a result of having done that, I thought I'd quite like to write my own book on the subject. And so that's a book called Goodbye to All That? The Story of Europe Since 1945 is coming out in early 2014 with OUP. It picks up on some of the things that we've been discussing today, but in a much more general context. It's also a history of the Cold War and many of the other key events of post-war European history, the European Union and so on, the rise and fall of the post-war consensus. But at the moment, I'm just started working on a book on the liberation of the Nazi camps, which is something, again, it ties into my interest in post-war European history. And it's something that has been curiously neglected, I think, that there is a growth in research on the early historians, on the early research institutes. There's been quite a lot of research done on DP camps. But with the exception of one or two classic studies, Robert Abzug and John Bridgman, there hasn't been a really good synthetic account of the liberation of the camps for some years. And so that's my next plan.
Well, that sounds wonderful, and I look forward to reading them. I want to say thanks again so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I wish you a pleasant summer when you get a chance to write and to read and reflect.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Dan Stone, author of the book Histories of the Holocaust. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll interview Annie Pullman and Deborah Meyerson about their recent edited collection, Genocide and Mass Atrocities in Asia, Legacies and Prevention. Until then, I hope you have a great month.